the next round on me. The scrounger put a bill on the bar that would cover his tab and theirs for at least an hour. Well, greetings, folks. How you doing? Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am very grateful that you joined me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Christopher Latrogna bring us our first story, and it's called A Rogue's Christmas. 1955, the Mississippi River, St. Louis. On Christmas Eve, aboard the Dutchess Riverboat, Henry made a toast. "To another year of staying above ground," Henry said, raising a glass. "And out of prison," Ivy said, clinking his. They stood at the bar in the Emerald Room aboard the Dutchess Riverboat. The Dutchess sailed nightly along the Mississippi, occasionally tucking into home base along the St. Louis shoreline before setting off again. Henry normally played poker in the Diamond Room. Ivy normally worked the surrounding city for suckers. Because of the holiday, they decided to forsake normal to just drink and be merry. Patrick had tended bar in the Emerald Room for years. He joined them with a small glass of something clear and clinked his glass to theirs. Henry drank his scotch and considered the almost empty room. "If I can't play cards, I don't mind this," he said, "drinking with friends, the room mostly to ourselves." They heard laughter from another part of the boat. "Ah, the coven," Ivy said. "They're back?" Henry asked, looking to the hallway where the laughter had come from. The coven was a group of four elderly women who liked to meet up two or three times a year to play bridge in one of the interior rooms aboard the boat. Their get-togethers depended on health and weather. Oh, they liked to dress up like it was a turn-of-the-century costume party with a full display of jewelry, feather hats, and ballroom dresses. Henry walked near the door to the hallway that led to the private room where the coven played. He heard more laughter and shook his head. "You know," he said as he walked back to the bar, "I tried to invite myself into one of their games once." "And they declined?" Ivy said. "Just so," Henry said. Then he indicated a sleeping person across the room. "So how long till we mention the urchin?" "This long, apparently," Ivy said. "Should we wake him?"
"Nah," said Henry. "Leave him be."
They spoke of a young passenger who sat at a side table on the far end of the craps room, feet stretched out in front of him, pretending to read a book. He wore a train engineer's cap with a bill down low so no one could see him sleep. The rest of his attire looked like a collection of hand-me-downs, a frilled shirt, slacks that were a size too small, and buckled shoes.
"What is he, 16? Henry asked.
"Seems about so," Ivy said. "How long's he been there?"
"He came aboard when I got here," Patrick said in his Irish brogue. "Tried to get a whiskey, accepted a Pepsi. Then just settled where you see him."
"Oh, not much of a Christmas," Henry said. Just then, a scrounger pushed through the beveled doors into the Emerald Room. A man somewhere between 60 and 90, with a grizzled beard and tattered vest, blinked as his eyes adjusted to the dim room. He stumbled, weaved, then focused on the trio at the bar and frowned. He seemed to question his eyes a moment. Then he smiled and walked toward them.
"Fellows," the man said, shouting louder than necessary, "I bid you season's tidings."
"Friend," Henry said, "as much as I'd love to stay true to the spirit of the season—"
"Oh, nonsense," the man spat. "The last thing you all want is a drunkard intruding on your party. What could be worse?"
"Perhaps you shouldn't shout," Ivy said.
"Oh, my—oh,
"My apologies," the man said, whisper shouting. "I'll try to manage it. I'm not normally so cartoonish. This time of year I find myself wistful, that's it, wistful, full of wist." At this point, the man seemed to finally focus on the three at the bar and register their looks.
"Season's tidings," he said again, then to Patrick, "put their next round on me."
The scrounger put a bill on the bar that would cover his tab and theirs for at least an hour.
"And with that, I'll adjourn."
The scrounger took the glass of beer Patrick handed him and wandered toward a round table. As he went, Henry called after him.
Hey, fella,
Henry said and indicated his glass.
"Thanks." "My pleasure," he said. "I find myself with more money to spend and stories to tell than time left on Earth. If you have the time, I have a tale to tell, a Christmas story, though a sad one."
"Thanks, mister," Ivy said, then turned toward Patrick, thinking they would resume their grifter's holiday. Henry kept his eyes on the scrounger as he collapsed into a wooden chair. Ivy shook her head.
"Let him be, Henry," she said.
"You know," Henry said, "I'm a sucker for a good story."
"Emphasis on sucker," Ivy said.
She looked at Patrick, who shrugged.
"Stories,"
Patrick said, his Irish accent turning it into a longer word,
"are my stock in trade. People can drink anywhere. I also want to hear the sad tale."
"Cheers to that," Henry said, clinking Patrick's glass.
"Okay," Ivy said, "but before we hear, do let me announce my resolution."
She took her glass of Chardonnay and lifted it. "I swear on the water below our feet to hang on to what I have."
"What prompted that?" Henry asked.
"A hunch," she said. Henry and Patrick clinked her glass. At that, Henry called to the scrounger.
"Hey, fella," he said, "let's hear that story."
The scrounger's eyes lit up, and he got up to join them. As he walked, he noted the sleeping teenager at the side table.
"Hey, what's with the vagabond?" he asked.
"Anyone's guess," Henry said. "Now, why don't you tell us the tale?"
"I was a professor at St. Louis University," the scrounger said. "Years ago, Professor Dave Lincoln, that's me, Calculus 101. I did that for 20 years. It was the first class on the first day after winter break, and I was teaching a bunch of students who did not want to be back at university. While I was teaching class, I heard a commotion down the hallway. Through the window, into the hallway, I saw people running past it. Then more shouts, and no one in my class was paying attention anymore, so we all went to investigate. And down the hall, I remember it was room 108. My colleague was dead." At this point, the professor stopped to take a drink. He looked at Henry, Ivy, and Patrick. His eyes were grave. "Professor Diane Carabel, physics. Some students had looked through her class window and saw her lying on the floor. They tried to open it, but it was locked. They ran to get a custodian, and he unlocked the door, but someone had scraped a desk chair up against the doorknob, so it took them another few minutes of pushing and scraping to get it open. And they found her there, strangled with a scarf, which was still around her neck. And you know what else? All three windows to the room were locked on the inside."
"No way in? No loose ceiling tiles or air vents?" Henry asked. The professor shook his head.
"One air vent, barely a foot square. No one could fit through it, not even a child. This was an old building, so no modern ductwork or anything like that. The casement windows had those twist-turn handles on them,
so no way to close it after you left. Nope. Professor Diane Carabel died in an empty room. The professor left them to think about this while he took another drink or two. Then he looked up at a clock over the bar.
Is that time accurate? He said.
Ah, sure, said Patrick.
11:30, the professor said. The police believe Professor Carabel died about this time on Christmas Eve. Are we the only ones aboard?
Oh, just about, Henry said. There are a few here and there, and a private game.
Just then a crashing sound, followed by laughter.
Ah, the professor said. Would that be the private game?
Was that the end of it? Ivy asked.
I'm sorry?
The dead professor, Ivy said. Was that the end of the story?
Oh, no, the professor said. The police concluded that Professor Carabel had killed herself, that she had locked herself in the classroom, fashioned her scarf into a noose, and tied it to a ceiling fan. Over the course of the winter break, the noose had come loose from the fan, dropping her to the floor with the scarf on top of her. Just as we found her, I wasn't so sure. She was pretty, so perhaps a jealous suitor? But I realized that I was perhaps pining for a grislier explanation for my own dark entertainment, and so did everyone else. I decided to accept the explanation. She was one of the first women hired for such a high position. Perhaps the pressure was too much. Then, a week after her death, I was teaching class, and a student raised his hand and asked me a question. The professor paused once more to take a sip of his drink, clearly enjoying the anticipation. He put the drink down and looked them in the eye. The student was a sophomore boy, always shy and never spoke. His name was William. To stop me mid-lecture like that was quite out of character, so I was surprised when he spoke up, and even more surprised by what he asked. Here the professor mimicked, raising his hand, and then said softly,
Professor, he said to me, why would Professor Carabel's killer take her watch?
Excuse me.
This last remark was directed behind him to the street urchin who was now awake and had a hand on the professor's shoulder trying to get past him to talk to Patrick.
Can I get a drink now?
Said the urchin, his high voice betraying his age.
I don't know, Patrick said. Have you aged 5 years in the last 10 minutes? Oh, come on, it's Christmas, said the urchin.
Good point, Patrick said. Merry Christmas. Would you like another Pepsi on the house?
The urchin looked at the remaining members of the party with disgust. Henry thought he was trying to think of something smart to say. Failing that, the urchin just made a pfft sound and walked off. They watched him saunter slowly through the room and to the far doors leading to the broad deck beyond.
Curious, said the professor.
Professor, said Henry, what's with the watch?
Hmm?
Said the professor, then remembered his story. Yes. The watch, you see, the student William told me he had a class with Professor Carabel, and being the professor of physics that she was, she liked to use it as an example.
An example of what? Asked Henry. Everything, apparently, said the professor. Time, gravity, force, mass. A watch needs all of it to do the one thing it does tell time. And she liked to point it out to the class. She considered it the most useful invention ever. A way to measure something unmeasurable. And she liked hers quite a lot. A large face, blue leather band. William said he was one of the students who first found her body and immediately noticed the watch was missing.
Well, that seems pretty personal, Ivy said. The professor nodded sadly, and Henry sensed genuine feeling in the man. Henry turned to Ivy.
Got any ideas?
Well, not exactly, she said, then looked at the professor. What about you?
The professor shook his head.
No, he said, but I tell the story every Christmas, hoping someone will see something I didn't.
Murdered on Christmas, Henry said. Then to the professor, they never solved it?
No, the professor said. No, they didn't.
A silent moment came and went. Then Henry asked, any ideas where our urchin went to?
Well, he can't have gone far, Ivy said.
Henry stood and straightened his back.
I think I'll go chat with the lad while I consider the tale.
Want company?
Ivy said. Well, certainly.
The professor turned to Patrick and indicated his empty glass.
Good man, he said. I wonder if I could trouble you for another.
Got it lined up? Ivy asked as the cold air met them.
The murder? Henry said. I've got inklings. You?
Yeah, the same, Ivy said. And there's our stowaway.
Further down the dock, the now-awake urchin leaned against the rails, overlooking the passing Mississippian smoked cigarette.
Hey, kid, Henry said as they got closer.
The teenager turned to look at them and pulled his cap closer down to his eyes.
Yeah,
he said, his voice a tenor.
What's your story? Henry asked.
Just getting some air. What's it to you?
Oh, nothing, Henry said, then turned to Ivy. Only we figured you had some other plans while you were on board.
Now, change of scenery, that's all, said the kid. Am I trespassing or something?
Oh, no, not exactly, Henry said. But just curious. If I was to pick you up and shake you, any chance of loose change coming out?
The kid's eyes went wide, and he immediately went into a defensive stance, but Henry was faster and grabbed his collar and pulled him close.
Relax, protege, Henry said, then pushed him back against the rail.
What did you call me? The kid said.
Henry looked at Ivy. You gonna fess up to this one? Ivy gave a vixen smile, then said to the kid,
At ease, Tyler. He's on to you.
Henry shook his head. I'm just going to assume I wasn't practice, Henry said.
Why not clue me in?
Ivy shrugged.
I got to know what I'm working with, she said.
Then to the kid, Do you know where you messed up?
Tyler, the street urchin, crossed his arms.
No,
he said. Ivy looked over at Henry, who looked at Tyler.
You didn't, Henry said.
What?
Said the kid and Ivy at the same time.
Henry said to Ivy, You're territorial. Here's another shark in the water, and you couldn't be bothered.
Henry saw Tyler start to smile and pointed a finger at him. But you needed to work on your voice. It's a dead giveaway.
To what?
Henry rolled his eyes.
Oh, it don't matter to me, Henry said. You can pull off the boy thing while you're young, but eventually you better put some character into it or you'll have to ditch it altogether.
Darn it, said Tyler in her authentic alto. We didn't do anything right.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, Henry said. Any chance you tap the senior citizens in there?
Tyler looked to Ivy, who nodded.
Yeah,
Tyler said. Henry held out his hand, palm up. Tyler again looked at Ivy.
The cost of doing business,
Ivy said. Tyler frowned and reached into her jacket pockets and pulled out a thick brown wallet.
That's it? Henry asked.
Tyler held his look, but was still green, so she dropped her eyes and pulled out one more item.
Henry took it and showed it to Ivy.
This what you expected?
Well, maybe not quite that, Ivy said, but I'm not surprised.
Henry took the wallet and flipped it open. He sorted through it, then handed it back to Tyler.
Go put it back where you found it, Henry said.
What?
Tyler said. Why? First, there's nothing in it. Second, so we can keep things quiet. Tyler snatched the wallet and walked away moping.
Fine.
Henry and Ivy stayed behind and watched Tyler walk away, then transitioned into more of a shuffle, resuming the urchin persona.
Where'd you find her? Henry asked.
Ivy shrugged.
Well, I caught her fingers in my purse along Market Street. It being the holiday season, I thought maybe I'd give her a chance. Where are you going?
Henry took the small ladder up to the ship's main cabin.
Back in a second, he said.
Ivy waited a moment, noting that the boat was headed back to shore. Henry returned in a moment with a pair of binoculars at his side.
Sightseeing,
Ivy said. Testing a theory, he said. Care to guess? He led her around the ship's bow to the port side and held the binoculars up to his eyes. He trained his sights on St. Louis's downtown. He nodded, then handed her the binoculars.
Check out the landing party, he said.
Ivy looked through the binoculars and found the boarding area where the Duchess routinely docked. There, she saw a few people waiting the ship's arrival, some looking more serious than others. She put the binoculars down and looked at Henry, then held up a finger.
Hang on, she said. I want to guess.
Sure, Henry said. But think quick. We don't have a lot of time. Ivy narrowed her eyes to the distant dock, and then she snapped her fingers. Got it, she said, and told him.
Well, that's how I see it, Henry said.
So here's what I propose.
Are they coming back? Asked the professor.
Patrick cleaned an imaginary stain along the bar and shrugged.
Well, your guess is as good as mine, Patrick said.
Well, I must deboard, said the professor. Happy holidays to you, and thank them for the company.
Same to you, said Patrick, and watched the man walk out of the bar.
The professor walked slowly along the broad side of the boat to the entrance gate as the ship lined up against the dock. A deckhand stood and threw a rope up to the waiting dock where a small party of people waited for the next outing. Two of the men, dressed in long coats and long faces, walked over to the professor.
Ready? Said one of the men.
The professor nodded slowly, then about-faced and led the men back through the boat past the main hall and down a hallway to where the coven played their annual holiday game.
They're down here, said the professor. Let's get them first. Then we can take care of the rest of the boat once it sets sail.
The professor stood by the door and listened. He could hear muffled voices on the other side of the door. High spirits, lots of jewelry, just waiting. He looked back at the two men who had retrieved their heavy-looking revolvers. They nodded.
Let's go.
The professor turned the knob and pushed. The door didn't budge. He looked down in confusion, then kept pushing. Someone or something on the other side of the door seemed to be pushing back, keeping the door in place. The professor put his shoulder into it, really shoving, and felt the door scrape an inch.
Help me, would you? He said to the two goons, who walked up alongside him and joined the pushing.
The three of them pushed the door open inch by inch. Inside, the voices continued their merriment, seemingly unconcerned with what was going on in the hallway. Finally, they got the door open wide enough to enter. The professor kicked aside the chair that had been wedged under the doorknob and turned to survey the room, which was empty.
Where are they? Said one of the goons.
Voices continued to come from the far corner of the room by a table. The professor walked over to the source, a Philco radio playing under a folded tablecloth. An announcer's voice blared through the mesh speaker.
You've just listened to Blonde Mink, an episode of Damon Runyon Theater. Merry Christmas to all of you out there in Radioland, and we're hoping you enjoyed the broadcast.
The professor threw the radio at the wall where it smashed.
Look at this, said one of the goons.
He stood at a table, smirking at a piece of paper.
What's this? Said the professor.
It's for you, said the goon.
The professor walked to the man and took the paper and read. As he did, his hand began to shake. Professor, the trick isn't how do you murder someone in a room and vanish. Well, that's impossible. The trick is how do you murder a dame in a school and close the door behind you with a chair wedged into it. And that's easier. You put a rope around the bottom chair legs, loose, wedge the top of the chair under the doorknob, and then you close the door by pulling the rope along under the door, dragging the bottom of the chair with you. Once it's shut, the chair is still wedged there, and you take the rope with you. We tried it here, and as you can see, it worked. Of course, you know this since you killed the woman yourself. The vagabond took your watch off you. Big face, blue band, just like the one you said the lady wore. Why you go around telling people about it is anyone's guess. We think it's ego. You mention her high position. It was higher than yours. Also, you had time to kill until your friends came aboard. Ivy knew you were off when you walked in. You seemed surprised to see us, and you told your story to kill time and distract us. We rounded up the ladies and locked the door. As we write this, the plan is to watch you gather your boys, then get off when you're not looking. If you're reading this, you're doing pretty good. Well, we plan to call the cops, so figure by the time you figured it out what's what and read this, you've got about 20 minutes left of freedom. Seems fair to us. It's Christmas, after all. Happy New Year, Henry, Ivy, and Tyler, too. All right, I'm switching over to the Alfred Hitchcock, the big book. His compendium of mystery writers, Roderick Wilkinson, writes this one, and it's called Pressure. Don't let anyone tell you that this scotch boom is going to go on forever. I know it isn't. In fact, nearly everybody in America who blends it, bottles it, or sells it know that we simply can't go on importing millions of barrels of a liquor from a tiny island off the coast of Europe just because it can't be made anywhere else in the world. Oh, yes, we make whiskey in the U.S. Everyone knows that. It's darn good whiskey, too. Don't try to tell me that a Southern Mash or a Kentucky single grain doesn't make life a lot easier for millions of fastidious Americans, but a Scotch malt whiskey can't be made here. It simply can't be done. That's why, at a time when we're nearly colonizing the moon, it makes me mad to think that we have to get every single drop of the stuff from a country smaller than New York. Don't ask me why this is. If anybody should know the answer, I should. I've been in the whiskey business 40-odd years. I talk to whiskey men all day in my New York office, at the bonding warehouses, at the broker's places, in the U.S. grain distilleries, out in the field, in the bars, in saloons, at the dealer's places. I also discuss whiskey with my gardener on Long Island, my barber, my travel agent, Joe at the country club, my wife, and everyone else who will listen. Scotch is my business. It's something to do with the water. Not even the water in the lowlands of Scotland will do. It must be the water from a peaty highland river like Spey or Lochy or Liffey.
It is also something to do with the barley they use. Plump Aberdeen or Angus or Banff barley is taken up every year by the Scottish distillers, whole harvests at a time. All the rest has something to do with the peat fire they use under the still. The aromatic juices in the hot stills, which haven't been cleaned out in 150 years, the temperature, the humidity, the skill of the stillmen, who know exactly when to run off, as it's called in the industry. If there's anything else, it must be witchcraft, and believe me, that wouldn't surprise me about the Scots. All I get is the product, and all I know is that I have to import barrels and barrels of the stuff to make a living for about 2,000 of my employees who work three shifts getting it on the market. Now, I want to tell you about a day last March when a gray-haired man called Ogilvy from our Scottish supplier phoned me from Glasgow. The conversation went something like this.
Mr. Sullivan.
Yes?
This is Hector Ogilvy from Glasgow.
Hello, Hector.
I'm phoning you because I don't want to put any of this in writing.
Oh?
You know Andrew Lamont?
I don't think so.
Yeah, you do. You met him at our Tumitole distillery last summer. He was the tall man, about 30, wore a white coat, black hair.
Oh, yeah, he had a blonde wife, good-looking girl.
Aye, that's him. He's our chemical engineer based here in Glasgow. He was at Tumitole on a visit when you were there.
Okay, what about him? I heard him breathe before he said,
he made 10 gallons of Islay malt artificially last week.
It was a few seconds before I thought what to say. If it had been anyone else but Hector Ogilvy on the other end of the phone 4,000 miles away, I would have made polite noises and hung up. But this was a whiskey man talking. Ogilvy had been managing one of Charlie McIntyre's distilleries in Glenaskey for years. I said,
it went back to raw alcohol.
It didn't.
Then it didn't hold the flavor.
It did.
It won't mature.
It will.
I found my voice a little thicker.
You're kidding.
I am not. He proved it out many times.
Who knows about it?
You,
me,
and him.
What about McIntyre?
He doesn't know.
He wouldn't know what to do if he did. Lamont says the development's got to be done here in America. There isn't enough money here.
What do you want me to do?
Get Bailey, Green, and Pudner lined up. I think I can bring Lamont over to New York next week for a test demonstration. He'll need a lab and three assistants.
Well, they'll take some convincing. So will I. We'll need to see long-term tests.
You'll also need a lot of money.
Well, they came over. I got the other three whiskey men together, and by the time Lamont had worked on the fourth test, I had a feeling we had kissed goodbye to 400 years of the Scotch whiskey industry as we knew it. That meeting was supposed to last 3 hours, and it lasted 5 days. We almost slept in the place. Lamont worked behind locked doors, but he showed us all what we wanted to know. First, he distilled a few pints from corn. Then he went on to coarser grain like maize. He finished up producing 3 gallons of the loveliest peat-tanged, malt-flavored nectar we have ever tasted from a sack of Oklahoma potatoes. He matured it by electronics. I don't know if you realize what I'm saying here, but to get the picture straight in your mind, it was as if somebody from Vienna had brought over a computer and composed, scored, and played music that suddenly put everyone who made music all over the world out of business overnight. Opera organizers, orchestral leaders, recording artists, singers, and musicians finished. That was the size of the problem we had at 4 a.m. on the 18th floor of the Talmadge building in New York. And it wasn't nice. The next day we rushed in the specialists from the Midwest, men who knew whiskey even better than we did. Tasters, smellers, sniffers, blenders who could tell precisely what kind of Orkney or Speyside would mix best with the sharp water of East San Francisco. they passed Andrew Lamont's product as one of the finest Glenlivets they had ever tasted.
The potato reached a dizzy height in the history of liquor business that night, that's for sure. At first, everyone was too scared to talk money. I just kept walking the carpet and horse-talking about international consequences in the spirit trade, responsibilities far beyond the immediate profit incentives, a breakthrough in our industry as far-reaching as the atom bomb. Ogilvy glared through his spectacles and said, "Somebody's got to get it started. It's time to do it. It's here and now. Let's get something drawn up." He talked as if he were Lamont's theatrical agent. Harold Bailey, a big whiskey man from the West Coast, agreed with him. "Ah, to hell with this international consequences jazz. Is this the United Nations? Let's sign them up now, at least with provisional contract." The other two whiskey men, James Green and O.B. Pudner, kept silent. They looked scared out of their wits with the Scotsman's discovery. They knew this was the end of the Scotch trade. At this time, Lamont just drew squiggles on a scratch pad and looked sad. Everybody knew what everybody else was thinking. This was survival day, and the men who signed up Lamont would make a fortune. Those who didn't were done. We all started pushing Lamont at once. Provisional rights for 6 months, guaranteed exclusives for 3 years, outright payments, royalties, stock sharing. And the more we pushed, the sadder Lamont looked. I hoped he was just tired. Let me think about it, he said as he took off his white lab coat. We've plenty of time.
Bailey got panicky. Yeah, you do that, Andrew. You think about it, and while you're doing that, somebody in Germany or Japan will get on to the method in a month and sell the world out in a year.
He started packing up his things. They won't get in on it. It took me 8 years working night and day. This is no do-it-yourself whiskey water. It's complicated.
He smiled before he left.
I want to think about it. His mouth was tight.
We nearly went mad. Think about what? What was he trying to do? Hike the price into billions? He had no sense of decency. Think about it. Bailey and I kept talking to him all the way back to the hotel. Then I went down to the airport and tried again.
Just tell me why you want to delay, Andrew.
He leaned against the stair railing.
I'll try. What is Scotland anyway? The top part of a small volcanic hiccup off the coast of Europe. 5 million people. You could lose it in Los Angeles. We don't have much. A reputation for building ships, playing the bagpipes, and making tartan and whiskey. That's about it. One way or the other.
He lit a cigarette.
Maybe we should keep the little we've got.
Listen, Andrew. I know how you feel, I said, but you can't keep back progress. You found the way to mass-produce Scotch malt whiskey anywhere in the world. This'll take money to develop, and a plant, and men, and materials. Let me develop it. I can raise the money.
Good night, Alex. He held out his hand.
I watched them walk to the runway for the plane. Hector Ogilvy was waving his arms in front of him, and from where I stood, looked as if he were swearing continuously at the thickest, most stupid chemical engineer in the whiskey business. I think I'd better tell you something about myself at this stage. Then you'll know why I went straight back to my New York office that evening and did some very clear thinking. I'm 52 years of age, although I don't look it. My father was an Irish immigrant, and my mother came from Liverpool in England. You'll pardon my inverted snobbery if I tell you I came up the hard, hard way near the New York waterfront. And you'll pardon me if I leave out some of the years during Prohibition. Let's just say that's how I got into the liquor business. I married Kate Bergman in 1933, divorced her in 1939, I married again in 1942, and Lucy and I live on Long Island in a fine house with all the trimmings. Our boy Larry works with me in the business. He's sharp. Don't press me for details. That's about the size and breadth of my life. Better people than you have tried to put a bite on me by digging up some early Sullivan relics on the waterfront. I sat in my office that night, and when all the anger and scare had left me, I began to laugh. You know what this was, don't you? This was a situation, and I hadn't been in one of these in years. Business problems? Oh, yeah, plenty of them. But something like this? Well, not since Ed Buccelli and I worked together, and I got myself in a situation that had to be handled, managed, fixed. I put together the facts. A young Scots chemical engineer had found a way of making Scotch malt whiskey artificially from almost any kind of vegetable matter that would produce ethyl alcohol. If this development were launched anywhere in the world, Scotch whiskey would no longer be a monopoly of the Scots. It could be produced in the Gobi Desert from sagebrush. It needed money to develop it. I could get money. If I had the patent or the rights, I could make a fortune and put every other Scotch importer in the world out of business. So I had to have that patent or the know-how. That's me. Why should I try to sell you otherwise? Do you know, imagine I got to the top of the liquor business letting someone else manipulate things? I picked up the telephone book and looked for Buccelli. Ed was a good starting point. The man who came to see me later that night on Long Island looked like a lawyer. He was medium height, had black wavy hair, nice brown eyes, and a broad face that smiled easily. His name was Daly, and he spoke with a Scottish accent. I took him into the library, and I poured drinks. That was quick. "Aye, Mr. Buccelli said that you were in a hurry, Mr. Sullivan." He sat down in a big hide chair, and I noticed how well cut was his dark gray suit. I sat on the sofa and hoped I looked younger than I felt at this 30-odd-year-old. Clear-cut, serene, executive type, you know. "Did he tell you anything about what I want?" "Only that you had an assignment you wanted to talk over." He sat back. I sipped my drink. "Are you on your own or with an organization?" He brought out a wallet, from it a card which he handed to me. It read, "Gascoigne Peterson Incorporated, 328 44th Street, New York, New York, USA. I had to use my reading glasses. I said, this doesn't tell me much. "I'm not selling my company services, Mr. Sullivan." He picked up his glass. "That doesn't give me much encouragement to buy them." "I'm not encouraging you." He took some whiskey. I sighed. This was not going to be easy. What was the world coming to? You ask for a pressure service, and what do you get? You get a crease-panted young so-and-so sitting back drinking your whiskey, not giving a darn whether he wanted your work or not. In the old days, well, times have changed. I said, "Let me tell you the story." I told him about Lamont. When I had finished, he lit a cigarette, leaned forward, and exhaled smoke slowly as he stared at the floor. "You want the know-how, legally or illegally. That means you want Lamont, right? Can you raise the money?" "Yes." "How much?" I shrugged and rose to refill our glasses. "How much? I'd seen the day when anybody you hired to lean on somebody, well, I suppose those organizations operate differently now." I said, $500,000. "Is it worth that?" "Every cent, I know." He accepted the refill thoughtfully. "Is there a time factor?" "Yes, tomorrow." He grinned. "Let's be realistic. That guy Lamont is on a plane tonight with enough power in his skull to blow my whiskey business and everyone else's in the world to smithereens in a week. He'll be wandering around Scotland asking for something to happen to him. I want him and his know-how back here working for me within weeks. Is that realistic?" Maybe. He was making notes in a little pad. "He's married, got children." I began to feel better about Daly. I smiled. "Mr. Daly, there's something I like about you and your outfit. You get to where people live." We finished about 2 a.m., and by the end of our meeting, I began to have a fresh respect for the modern approach of today's professional pressure business. There was no doubt about it. Things had come a long way since Ed Buccelli, and I made our first few $1,000s unprohibiting on the New York Riversides. Gascoigne Peterson got my account that night. My reckoning was that I had about 6 weeks at the outside to get Lamont's know-how into my business. I had no complaint when Daly visited me at my office in New York the following afternoon with a portfolio which he put down in the desk in front of me. It was titled Project 183. I grinned as he sat in front of my desk. I wonder what the other 182 were. Successful. He lit a cigarette. The 22 sheets of typewritten paper in the portfolio were laid out like a marketing plan or a new financial venture or a research report. In these later days of my business running, I had seen hundreds like it. This one was exceptional. It planned only one thing, how to get me Andrew Lamont's process for making Scotch whiskey artificially. Important giveaway words were coded. Whiskey was called China Clay, and Scotland was called Panama. Only Daly and I knew the code words. I took 3/4 of an hour to read it while Daly looked out the window and smoked cigarettes. When I had finished, I asked, "How much?"
$40,000.
Ah, you're crazy. He came over to the desk, took the portfolio, and put it in his briefcase. He had put his hat on when I said, "All right, I'll buy it." I had a feeling you didn't mess around with these people. Times had changed. The first part of the plan involved me personally. The agreement was that if I succeeded and there was no need for further intervention by Gascoigne Peterson, my outlay would be a token, one of $5,000. Naturally, I wanted that part to succeed, although I didn't have much hope. Helen Lamont was a good-looking woman. When she walked into the cocktail bar of the hotel in Glasgow, dressed in blue, I felt glad I had no stomach or double chin. She smiled.
Mr. Sullivan.
I rose. Yes, Mrs. Lamont. We shook hands. I'm glad you could come. Won't you sit down? She was shapely and had a clear pink complexion.
Thanks for describing the color of your tie. It's distinctive indeed.
I met you once at a distillery opening in the Highlands, but I felt you wouldn't know me again. That's why I mentioned the tie.
Did you have a pleasant flight?
For the wife of a Scots whiskey chemist, she seemed very assured. Well, yes, thanks. I ordered drinks as she took off her white gloves. Yes, Mrs. Lamont was a good-looking woman. She had a very shapely neck and very clear blue eyes. Did your husband enjoy his few days in New York?
No, not very.
He didn't say much about it to me, but I got the impression it was keeping him very busy. Of course, Andrew doesn't discuss business with me very much. She looked me straight in the between the eyes. So I don't ask a great deal. He tells me what he wants to tell me. That suits me. The waiter brought the drinks, and this gave me some time to think about how I should approach her. Mrs. Lamont, I think you know why I'm here today.
I could make a guess, I.
You know why your husband was in New York with Mr. Ogilvy?
Yes, she smiled.
I lifted my glass and smiled. Well, that makes my job easier.
Does it?
Do you want him to make a lot of money from his whiskey process?
If that's what Andrew wants.
She sipped her drink as if there were nothing more to say. It took me a few seconds to get used to it. You haven't told me what you want. She nodded and put down her glass.
Mr. Sullivan, I think I know what you want. You would like me to try to influence my husband to sell you or lease you the rights of his process. You want to negotiate.
I offered her a cigarette, which she accepted. I admire your sense. Now, don't misunderstand me. I want to buy that process at a price which would make your head swim.
My head doesn't swim easily. I think I know what it's worth, although I don't know anything about the process. I can tell you in a nutshell all I want. I want him to sell out so that he and I and the children can have all we've wanted for years. I want us to be rich.
I had a real job stemming my enthusiasm.
Then why in the world doesn't he sell it to me?
Because he has scruples.
Scruples about what?
You don't have to have scruples about anything, Mr. Sullivan. You just have to have them. Some people have a lot of them, like freckles or hair in their heads. My husband is one of those.
She sighed.
I know how he feels about this. He doesn't want to be the means of ruining the Scotch whiskey industry. He says it's like killing the French wine industry.
She played with her glass.
Scotland means a great deal to him.
Mrs. Lamont listened to me. It was the way she moved her eyes very slightly that made me turn around in my chair quickly. Andrew Lamont was standing right behind me. I felt terrible. Then I felt angry.
Don't get up, he said, smiling.
He moved around and sat in the vacant chair at our table.
You never give up, do you, Alex?
I lit a cigarette.
No, I don't.
Mrs. Lamont appeared a little embarrassed. Frankly, that's how I saw it, too. She said,
I told Andrew you asked me to meet me here today. I don't keep secret appointments, Mr. Sullivan.
I tried to smile. Look, let's face this right in the teeth.
Andrew?
No, you face it right in the teeth, Alex, Lamont said. I know what my wife wants because she's laid all her cards on the table to me. She wants the Lamont family to make a lot of money from this process. I know what I want. I want the process to be proved a success. And I know what you want. You want to make your hands on the process so you can corner the artificial Scotch market and put everybody out of business in 2 years.
He lit a cigarette.
There's just one snag. Nobody's gonna get what he wants because I'm not prepared to kill off a traditional industry that's been exclusive to this country for 500 years.
Mrs. Lamont was looking at the water jug.
I sighed and swallowed some temper.
You really mean that?
That's exactly how I see it.
I got up because I couldn't just sit there and watch that jumped-up Scottish peasant lay down a statement like that which left me no room to move even an inch. No negotiation, no compromise, no nothing. So I pushed back my chair and said,
You're gonna see this another way soon.
I thought of the balance of payment to Daly and I felt angrier.
I don't think so. Oh, but I know so.
Don't you be crazy enough to imagine you can sit on something like this on your own terms and hold back progress of this size in the liquor industry, Lamont. If you don't have the brains to sell this process now to the industry, you'll have to be treated like an escaped lunatic and the responsibility taken out of your hands.
And to be put into yours, Mr. Sullivan.
It was Helen Lamont who spoke.
Yes. I have the money and the facilities to develop it, and I'm going to use them.
Lamont took his wife's arm, and she stood up as he said,
I wouldn't do a deal with you on the process if you are the last whiskey man in the world, Sullivan. Goodbye.
I went out and straight to room 418, where Daly was waiting for me. He laid down his newspaper as the door slammed.
No dice.
Pull a switch, Daly. Give them everything. You sold me pressure, I bought it. Now you apply it, and fast.
I received no calls on Saturday or Sunday, and I got to my office early on Monday morning.
Daly was looking out the window of my office when I walked in. He didn't even turn around.
Hello, I said as I put my hat on the rack.
He said nothing.
I walked behind my desk and sat down. I was about to talk to him again when I saw the package of papers, fastened with an elastic band and topped with a letter. I picked it up warily, as if I knew already it was something very important. The letter was multigraphed and began, Dear Blank, then followed my name, handwritten in ink.
You'd better read it, Daly said in a flat voice.
I ripped off the elastic band, and the following is what I then read.
Dear Mr. Sullivan, the enclosed papers, drawings, and chemical specifications will give you full details of the method for the production of Scotch malt whiskey from any basic vegetable matter. The process has been scientifically proved at various periods under various conditions and at numerous locations over the past 8 years.
Any further information you require about the process will be supplied to you free of charge on request from the writer. You should know that facsimile copies of the drawings and the specifications of the process have been mailed to every liquor-producing company in the world simultaneously. There are 1,153 such companies in the mailing. Yours faithfully, Andrew Lamont.
My hands were trembling. I dropped the package on the desk. What the hell is this?
Daly turned around.
Mr. Lamont has delivered. This damn letter, it's duplicated. He sent it everywhere.
That's what he says. He sent it to every important manufacturer in the world.
He sat down opposite my desk.
Did you know it was there?
He lit a cigarette. I knew he was sending it. I came off the plane from Scotland this morning. Before I left, he showed me a copy of it, and the drawings and specifications.
I felt my voice bleeding. But he sent it everywhere.
Aye, all over the world. The printing and mailing costs were £800. He paid it himself.
He's nuts.
It was his wife's idea. She's a very clever woman. She organized it the day you left them in Glasgow.
But what do I get out of this?
Nothing.
I felt the sweat on my upper lip.
Nothing? I tried to laugh. Well, you can't beat a public announcement, can you? You can't patent something everybody's got, can you?
I took out my handkerchief and patted my mouth. This guy's fooled us all, or his wife has.
There was silence. We looked at each other. Then I saw Daly smile and fetch a slip of paper from his pocket. He laid it on my desk.
May as well get this all over with in one morning, Mr. Sullivan.
What's this?
That's our bill.
Bill? For what?
I picked up the paper. I don't remember what I said. All I can remember is my own babbling voice. I felt terrible, but I couldn't stop.
$40,000? This is crazy. You can't charge me for this. I know I said I wanted this process, but not like this. You must see that yourself. It's unreasonable. You can't push me into this. It's a lot of money. There were certain conditions. Oh, be fair. What about a drink? Could we talk this over? I didn't know it would turn out like this. Be reasonable.
I was still talking in a funny kind of high voice when Daly went to the door and opened it. Two large men came in quietly, and one of them took a rubber truncheon from his pocket. I tried to scream, but no sound came out. I heard Daly say,
"Leave his right arm intact. He'll need it for signing the check."
Well, friends, I'm out of time. Keith Tyler saying thanks for joining us on the Mystery Hour here at Sun Sounds of Arizona, and please do tune in again next time. Thanks, and make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.